Hello. This edition of Meet the Writers was recorded at Adelaide Writers' Week, which took place last month in Australia. Today, my guest is not only a writer, but a musician and a teacher too. Well known in Australia as a female presenter on ABC Classic FM, she knew she was transgender, but felt it was a hopeless situation, which she was unable to change. In 2016, she travelled to teach at the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. There, in war-torn Kabul, she realised that she could be who she wanted to be and returned to Australia to begin transitioning from female to male. Eddie Ayres, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, you were born a girl called Emma in England in 1967 and grew up in Shrewsbury, a town that had a thriving music scene. You started learning the violin at the age of 8, although actually would rather have played the cello like your brother. Switching to the viola, which was a much better fit, you progressed fast, getting scholarships and attending the Royal Northern College of Music, then going on to study in Berlin and with the Amadeus at the Royal Academy, before in 1991 getting a job playing in an orchestra in Hong Kong. That was during the lead-up to the handover. You moved to Hong Kong at the age of 24, at a time when you were beginning to come to terms with your sexual identity. Can you give us the background to that?
Well, when I was sort of 13, 14, I realised that I was staring at girls and imagining kissing them. And it didn't take me very long to then realise, oh, I'm a lesbian. And sadly, back in the late 70s, early 80s, this wasn't a happy realisation. I was going to an all-girls school, and the thing that you would say to somebody if you didn't like them, if you really wanted to upset them, was, you're a leso. So when I thought that I was a lesbian, this was clearly, you know, a terrible, terrible thing, and I kept it very, very quiet until I was 18. So the reason that I thought that I was a lesbian then was because I had no mirror for myself in British society. There were a few transsexuals, as we were known then, around, but they were often just the subject of ridicule and mockery. You know, really terribly cruel behaviour. I can't imagine the bravery of people who went through with transition back in that time. I mean, they're such brave people. We owe our lives, I think, to these people. But they were always the other way. They were always from male to female. I didn't even know that it was possible to transition from female to male until much, much later on. And so if you don't have that kind of mirror in your society of who you actually are, you just don't know about it and you have no other option. So the only option that I could see was, I'm a lesbian.
So off you went to Hong Kong.
So off I went to Hong Kong and played with the Hong Kong Phil for 8 years, pretty much 8 years. During that time, I met a friend called Terry Mountain, and Terry had a son called Simon. Now, Simon was going to one of these schools for kids with special needs, and they had a music program, a music therapy program, but the money for it had run out. And so I was beginning to think that there was more to life than being a rank and file viola player. And so I'd come up with this plan, I'd hatched a plan to go back to England and then cycle to Hong Kong. And instead of just doing it, I also thought, well, I should do it for money. You know, I should do it for a reason, to raise money for something. And so I worked out with Terry that I would raise money for this little school in Hong Kong to raise money for a year's music therapy. So that's what happened.
And now, of course, this is the subject of your first book. Tell me about the book, because it's very cleverly structured.
Music is constructed very clearly in terms of different keys and what notes go where. I drew out the circle of fifths with all the names of the keys, like G major, C sharp major, F minor. And so once I'd got that written down, I then, next to each key, put the stories that I wanted to tell about my own life and growing up through music college, and also the stories from this incredible year when I was doing this cycling. So it's not necessarily chronological, but it's musically ordered. It was an extremely cathartic thing to write, because one of the things that I did touch on in Cadence is this idea of gender, because when I was female-bodied, I presented as very androgynous. You know, I always had my hair short. I'm relatively tall, I suppose. I'd always been fairly muscular. And quite often I'd go into the women's loos and people would say, you know, why are you here? You're in the wrong loo, sort of thing. So when I was travelling, I played to that because it was just so much easier. I mean, especially if you're travelling in places like Pakistan. When I was in Pakistan, I dressed in men's clothes and I began to realise that nobody wanted to even think that I was a woman. When they asked me what my name was, I would say Emma, but they heard Emmett, which is a Pakistani name. It's amazing how people will just pick up on the smallest cues to hear what they want to hear. So they just saw me as a male and they heard me as a male. And so I spent most of my time in Pakistan, which was about 2 months, being asked into the male side of people's houses. Even to the point where I sat on a daybed with this one guy in a town called Bahawalpur. I sat with him and his son. I'd met his son on the street and he said, oh, you have to come back and meet my dad. I was like, yeah, sure. And the father at one point grabbed my leg and he said to his son, Sultan, he said, Sultan, you should have legs like Emmett. There's such strong male legs. And then at the end, I mean, he was such a generous man and he gave me this big bear hug. But all I could think was, I have to hug him in a way that he can't feel my breasts. So this carried on for weeks on end and it was wonderful and I felt very, very happy. And I wasn't really sure why I felt so happy. I mean, I love travel. I love the liberation of travel and the daily excitement of what's going to happen today. But what happened was when I arrived in Multan and I was so hot and so dirty and tired at this point, and I just thought, I'm going to check into a really nice hotel and I'm just going to kind of check out of Pakistan, at least for a night. So I arrived at this hotel room and put on the TV, and there was this film on the TV called Boys Don't Cry. It's the true story of a man called Brandon Tina, who was born Tina Brandon. And Brandon never medically transitioned in his life, but he presented absolutely as male with his clothes on. And he had a relationship with a woman in this small town in middle America. And a couple of young men in the town found out that Brandon was female-bodied, and they raped him and they murdered him. I was weeping uncontrollably, and I realized that this was me, that I'm transgender.
I want to fast forward a little bit here, because after this realization, which of course was absolutely huge in your life, the next kind of major plot point, if you like, is that you move to Australia, where you become incredibly well known as Emma on the radio as a host of a classical music show.
I loved it. You know, I really, really loved it. I was slowly promoted from doing overnights to evenings to afternoons to the breakfast program.
So you were a big name in radio here in Australia, but you just weren't happy.
No, that's right. I really wasn't. People may relate to this thing of depression, of it just slowly coming upon you. And I had no reason to be unhappy. It was a well-paid job. I was reasonably well-known here in Australia. I had a wonderful partner. I had a lovely place to live in Sydney. You know, there was no reason to be unhappy, but these tentacles of depression started to writhe around me. In the end, I had to give up work because I just couldn't be bright and happy on air. You know, I was a breakfast presenter. And how can you do a breakfast program if you're not feeling truly joyful yourself? So I decided to quit the radio, and I'd already spent some time in Afghanistan at this wonderful music school run by an Afghan-Australian chap called Dr. Sarmas. It's the only music school in the country. It's in Kabul. And I'd gone over there for a couple of weeks and I just loved it. You know, I fell in love with the kids and the whole idea of it. You know, it really played to my idea of wanting to spread music as much as possible. And so I knew that they needed a cello teacher. So I applied for the job. And so at the beginning of 2015, I moved to Kabul. I needed to escape what was going on in my head.
Going off to Kabul at that time, I mean, there were bombs going off. It was still basically a conflict zone. Of course, the Taliban had gone, but the residual effect and the fact that they had banned music, it was a country in absolute chaos.
Well, yes, it was. Although at the time, and this is the beginning of 2015, it wasn't as bad as it is now. You know, when I went, you could walk down the street fairly happily in particular neighbourhoods. You could go to certain restaurants. You could travel around the city in relative safety. But still, you know, there were a number of bombs that happened when I was there. Probably the biggest one was an attack on Parliament, which is relatively close to the school. And being inside a school with little children, you know, children as young as 8 or 9, when a huge bomb has gone off, and having to comfort them and look after them and distract them as their teacher, you know, it was this sort of work that I relished because it meant I didn't have to confront my own demons.
Some of the stories you tell in the book that you've written about this experience, Danger Music, are extraordinary. The school was one of the few places in Afghanistan which wasn't segregated.
Yes, that's right. I think it's the only school, or one of very few schools, that's co-educational. And the girls at the school were just remarkable. So the school has places reserved for girls, but also for kids who've been working on the street. So the school pays the family the money that the child would have earned on the street selling balloons or chewing gum or whatever. And they supply everything, you know, the instruments, the uniforms, the school books, the school lunch. And it means that children through all socioeconomic levels of society can come to the school, and that's absolutely what happened. One of the most remarkable people I've ever met, I met at this school, and her name's Lila. Well, that's the name I've given her. That's not actually her real name. I was teaching viola and cello and double bass at the school. Lila played the viola. And she'd come to the school a little bit late. She'd persuaded Dr. Sarmas to let her in, and she'd done all the study that everybody had learnt over the previous 3 years. She did in 3 months. And she was always top of her class. And she's Hazara, so the most persecuted minority in Afghanistan. Even though she was Hazara in their relatively open-minded society, still her uncles, with whom she lived, they were not at all supportive of her, first of all, going to school, and most definitely not of going to a music school. So she had to keep it quiet going to music school. She had to keep it a secret. Only her mother knew. Lila's father had died just after Lila was born. Her father was in his 60s, and her mother was 15 when Lila was born. Her mother had gone on to remarry, but the stepfather is now in Indonesia trying to come to Australia. So Lila lived with her mother and some distant uncles. And distant uncles in Afghanistan are always the most dangerous, because they're the ones who feel that they can tell women what they can and can't do. And also women are made to do all the work at home, as the men just basically just lie around. I mean, it's absolutely shocking. So Lila came to school every morning in her own clothes. She walked over an hour to school. She kept her uniform at school, changed into her uniform, stayed at school from 8 until about 5, and then did the reverse, going home. When she got home, she had to do the cooking, the cleaning, the ironing, and she had to keep playing music secret. So when I was with Lila, she had made a fingerboard. So if you think about a violin or a string instrument, the left hand is doing all the fingering to change the notes on the instrument. And it's a very complex thing, and it needs a lot of actual physical practice as well as mental practice. So Lila had made a wooden fingerboard so that she could at least practice the fingering for her viola when she was at home. She went home one day and asked her mum where her fingerboard was. She couldn't find it. And her mother had decided that it was just simply too risky to have this fingerboard in the house. One of the uncles might find it and say, "What's this?" And so the mother had burnt the fingerboard. So Lila was absolutely just left at home with no music at all. The only music she could have was the music that she kept in her head. So we talked a lot about doing mental practice and being able to run through her scales and through her pieces inside her head, and maybe just doing a little bit of fingering action just quietly. But Lila continued her practice, and she worked incredibly hard. She stayed top of her class all the way through school. And the last I've heard from Lila is that she was conducting the women's orchestra, and she's applied to Yale as an undergrad.
Throughout this time, of course, you're still Emma. You're wearing the hijab. You're identifying to everybody as female. Very, very difficult. But you got to the point where you decided, actually, now is the time. And you decided that you would transition.
Yes, so living in Australia, I'd managed to kind of weave this path through the middle. You know, I looked quite male, but I would be able to go into women's toilets and not usually with too much hassle. But what happened in Afghanistan, because it's such a clearly binary gendered society, I was forced, as you say, to wear the hijab. People called me Miss Ayres. I had to wear relatively feminine clothing. And day to day, it became more and more painful. And so all these feelings of dysphoria, they'd sort of come up sometimes like this great tsunami over the years. And I'd have frantic searches on the internet and look at female to male, F2M websites and read about men who transitioned. But I'd always thought, I can't do it because my partner at the time said that they didn't want to go out with me, that she identified as lesbian, she didn't want to go out with a man. And also I feel very strongly that as a female-bodied person, it's important to push the envelope of what it is to be female. In the end, the pressures were such that I finally accepted that I had to do something about it. And I think that's a really clear distinction, that we don't decide we're transgender. We realize we're transgender, you know, if we are. We accept it, and then we decide what we're going to do about it. Because some people decide not to do anything about it. You know, some people decide that they'll just stay as they are. Some people decide that they will transition, but they won't do a medical transition. And then all the way to the other end, where people fully medically transition, and they don't tell anyone about their past life, and that's called going stealth. And so, you know, if you're listening to this now and you're listening, maybe watching somebody coming down the street, they may be a stealth trans person, but they've taken their hormones, they continue to take their hormones, and you would never know otherwise. And so I decided that I had to do something about it. So I contacted a very good friend of mine in Australia, Carol, and she said, well, I know exactly who you need to talk to. She'd been a nurse. She was a retired midwife, actually. And she put me in touch with a wonderful gender doctor here in Brisbane. And I went to see her at Christmas 2015. And the first thing she said to me actually was, so Emma, being androgynous isn't enough for you anymore.
And that began the journey.
So some men, trans men, because we always talk about ourselves in the gender that we are, not where we started from, take testosterone first, and the idea is that your muscles build up enough to then have the surgery that will be clear where the scars need to go so that the pecs will eventually cover up that line. But I decided, because I wanted to go back to Afghanistan for at least another year, I decided that I'd have my chest surgery first. That would allay somewhat my gender dysphoria and my body dysphoria. I'd go back to Afghanistan after the chest surgery, and then after about a year come back to Australia and take testosterone. I went back, my very, very closest friends knew what was happening with me. They were so supportive, it was amazing. No Afghans knew, and that was, I think, quite important to keep it quiet. I think for the school, you know, it just would have been too much for Afghan society to have a transgender person at a music school. I had gone back to the school. I'd been there for maybe about 2 weeks only, and I was teaching a music theory class one day when I heard the most terrible scream. A girl called Yalda, again, it's not her real name. She was one of the older girls. She was an amazing pianist, conductor. And she, unbeknownst to anyone, had started up a relationship with one of the junior staff, a guy called Samim. Unfortunately, she'd taken photographs of them kissing. Now, this doesn't seem very bad, but there's kind of no equivalent in Western society. You know, if we took all our clothes off right here, right now, and had sex in the street, it's still somehow not as bad as having photographs of you kissing. And so one of the senior boys in the school had found these photographs on a thumb drive. He'd stolen them. He'd distributed them amongst the other boys in the school. Yalda found out about it. She was so shamed and so distressed that she went to the first floor of the music school and threw herself out of the bathroom window. It was that that had caused the screaming. She went to hospital. She survived. She damaged her back quite badly. She broke her foot, but she survived, thank heavens. And so I immediately went to Dr. Sarmast and said, you need to punish the boys who've done this. You know, they've committed a crime. They've stolen a photograph. They've basically distributed pornography. They've caused somebody to commit suicide, which is itself a crime in Afghanistan. And Dr. Sarmast, for whatever reasons, never did anything to punish the boys. Now, this was happening at the same time that here in Australia, we had a huge Royal Commission into institutional responses to child abuse. So it's mostly been pertaining to the Catholic Church, but also to sports clubs, to dance classes, also to some music teachers. And I just felt that I cannot stand by and let this happen. I cannot be part of a school where women's rights are not properly protected. One of the things about the school was that it was to advance women's rights, but I felt that when push came to shove and one of these girls' rights had clearly been so absolutely shattered, I just couldn't stand by and let it happen. And I tried as much as I could to get these boys punished, and it just didn't happen. So in the end, I thought, I can't stay here. This isn't my culture. I'll never understand it. And I just thought, I need to come back to Australia and I need to transition.
And that's what you did. So you started having hormone injections.
It was an extraordinary moment, you know, when I lay down in the doctor's surgery for the first time and had this testosterone injected into my body. And I was 49 and I really felt like I was being reborn. In fact, I absolutely had in my mind this feeling of coming out again through the birth canal. And it's taken its time. You know, I've been taking the drug for about a year and a half now. And the first thing I noticed was that I, within about a month, put on about 6 kilos, which was just simply my muscles getting bigger. My appetite increased massively. There were days where I just simply couldn't get enough to eat. I was perpetually starving. So if, you know, if anybody's dealing with a teenage boy who's always at the fridge wanting to eat, then it is absolutely the drug. You know, you just have to eat and eat and eat and eat. The next thing that started to change was my voice, which was so strange. You know, it was absolutely like a teenage boy, you know, with that sort of squeaky voice sometimes and then goes down very low. And it was so strange, you know, because I'd lived for 49 years speaking at a certain pitch, and it was like somebody had taken my cello strings and retuned them. So I spoke expecting a certain pitch, and this, you know, chaotic one would come out instead. And then I think, just hilariously, in a Freudian sense, the moment that my voice, I think, really truly dropped was when I was speaking to my mum on the phone, which was just hilarious. And it was like, ah, finally, my male voice has finally come out. I mean, it's still going up and down a little bit, but it's fairly stable now.
So we've just done a session at the Adelaide Writers Festival where you were talking on stage about your transition, about your life, about your latest book, bearing in mind that you had been very famous here in Australia as Emma. The reaction from the audience was extraordinary, so accepting, so loving, a huge standing ovation at the end. Has that been your experience generally, that people are accepting, that your mother, that your family, that your friends, and indeed your public have welcomed this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I acknowledge that my transition has been really easy. As easy as a transition can be. I mean, obviously there have been some very, very difficult days, especially in the years leading up to it. But the actual transition in terms of medical care, family care, the love of my partner, Carol, who is the original friend who I told about being transgender, and she fixed me up with doctors. She looked after me after my chest surgery. I've been incredibly lucky, because I think there are sadly a large number of trans people who, when they come out to their family absolutely rejects them. I've had to learn how to speak to men as a man, how to greet them, in a sense, how to walk down the street, how to talk to women who I don't know. That's actually a really important point, because when I was female-bodied, I could just chat to women, you know, that I didn't know. Let's say I was sitting on a plane, you know, if there's a woman sitting next to me, I'd happily have a chat, and she wouldn't be going, oh, you're a bit of a slime ball, what are you trying to do? I think something that really illustrates this is I was at a tailor's one day having some trousers taken up. So a woman working on the counter, and I was just waiting for my trousers, and so I was just having a bit of a chat. You know, I'm naturally a chatty person, and so I said to her, so what are you doing this weekend? And she immediately said, I'm going to a barbecue with my husband. You know, it was just so piss off, I am not open to any sort of chatting up. And so I immediately withdrew. You know, I think I almost physically withdrew, actually. So that sort of thing of being aware of a woman feeling safe with me, you know, I'm very aware I can't stand as close to women. To make a woman feel comfortable, I have to make sure that she doesn't feel trapped physically by me, that she doesn't feel like I'm coming onto her in any kind of way. So that's actually a great sadness for me, that that world of sisterhood is now absolutely closed to me. And that's the only thing that I regret. From going to having this wonderful conversation, you know, a deep, intricate, varied conversation with women, to now, like the first time that I went to a party when I was fully male-bodied, I went to a party, ended up standing with a group of blokes, you know, all of us with beer in our hand, and we all sort of stood there and nodded at each other, and one guy looked at me and he said, "So, Ed, what sort of car do you drive?" And I just thought, oh my God. At the time I thought, shit, what have I done? This is terrible. But I've now learned it is possible to talk to men about deeper things, but you just have to find the way. You know, it's perhaps a slower way in. And when men know about my own history, I mean, I don't sort of shove it down people's necks, but, you know, if they do eventually find out that I'm trans, then I think there is a sort of certain opening up that they have. I'd love to continue to talk to men about what we can do as men to access our own emotions, just that little bit more, because I do feel with this drug that it does change your thinking. You know, it does change your emotional response to people. It does change your sympathy. And, you know, not necessarily for the better. And as men, I think we can improve that, you know, and I think we have to. I think we have to lift our game. Another thing about people's view of trans people is that I think it's really important that we're seen as people who are just people. You know, we've got a medical condition. It's not a mental illness. It's a physical condition. I liken it to something like diabetes, that a diabetic has to take their insulin. I'm a trans man. I have to take my testosterone. I have to look after my health. I have to make sure I'm mentally and physically healthy. And then I'm fine. I can then go into society and contribute as much as I can.
And your tremendously honest book, Danger Music, is out now. Eddie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Georgina.
Danger Music is published by Allen and Unwin. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.